fire, but accidents will happen. So now he couldn't let anybody in on his secret. It would be insane to let the scientists find the cub again and kill it. But Jonesy, the cub was female, he discovered, whined and shivered in the root cellar, so he brought it upstairs. His mother was not pleased. "Look, Mom, I know it's humongous for a kitten, but that's all it is. Pet it." She refused to touch it. "I don't care what it is. I don't want it in my house. Listen, they'll kill it if I take it back. It's cute, see?" He held it to his chest to minimize her view of the monstrous head. Its fur was rough, not silky like a kitten's, but it was warm and happy to snuggle. "Cute, Kevin? I'll show you cute. I know you stole it from Frankenlab. It'll probably get up in the night and suck our blood." "Shit, Mom. It eats milk, not blood. You can't just kick it out on the street like a broken TV. Kevin, get a job and get that thing out of my house." But Kevin's mother was too tired to put her foot down. The cub's teeth started coming in. On a diet of ground meat that Kevin got from dumpster diving, it had loads of energy. It used the energy stalking Kevin and shredding everything in Kevin's room. The eye teeth erupted and erupted and erupted. Not domestic cat teeth. Long as the fishing knife the cops had taken away from him when he was caught with the pot. He woke up one morning to find the monster sitting on his chest, hungry, or affectionate, as if you could tell, even with a tame cat. "Man," said Kevin, peering closer, "your mom should have sued your orthodontist." The cub did not laugh. Not a vampire, but those sharp, sharp teeth. And then his mind chewed through a bunch of information and farted out the truth. Rumors of Ice Age frozen flesh? Cloning? Bingo! The damn thing, scrutinizing him with gold-green eyes, opening its huge mouth in a silent howl, was a saber-toothed tiger. "Whoa, dude. I thought you were trouble before." It would need lots more meat. At first, he bought cheap cuts. Then, when he realized his money from mowing lawns wasn't cutting it, he abstracted food from his own meals and from the refrigerator and dumpster dove the local supermarket. One day, he found his mother in the kitchen, her hand bandaged. He hoped the bite was from Rosebud, but if Rosebud had bitten her, she'd probably be a mangled corpse. He sank into a chair while the saber-tooth attacked the stinky mess he'd brought home for it. "That's it, Kevin. You're my only son, the light of my life, a good, smart boy, although way too trusting. But that cat is out by tonight, or I call the cops." She blew her nose on a crumpled tissue. "I know where he came from." Kevin didn't blame her. She was tired from overwork, just wanted to be left alone and sleep more than 5 hours at a time. They'd been moderately affluent before Kevin's dad left. But Dad had a really good lawyer. The measly child support had stopped when Kevin turned 18. Dad still sent birthday cards with a $2 bill in each.
"If the boy wants a college education, a job will make him appreciate it more."
Jobs. Yeah, well, jobs for 21-year-old guys who've done even a little time aren't easy to come by. Odd jobs, maybe shoveling walks in winter. Kevin wasn't a drinker, so he didn't have AA networking to fall back on. Also, the damn cub was too mischievous to leave alone for long.
The week before the cat nipped Mom, he'd come home from helping a neighbor get her hay in and found the cub playing with a large rat. When the saber-tooth saw him, she grabbed the rat in her mouth and tried to run away. Thank God it had been a rat and not those ratty-looking poodles the parks owned. So Mom was right. The cat needed a home. Sarah, their beginning romance had aborted, but he ran into her sometimes at the feed store. She'd understood Kevin didn't know about the pot. But she always said, "It's not a good time." If he wanted to come over to the farm or ask her out, not that he had much money for dates. Guess she didn't want to be with a loser. But hell, he could rise again. Many great men, millionaires, politicians had a shady past. Sarah didn't hate him. He put the cub in an appliance carton. It whimpered but complied. Wrapped it with pink and ivory paper and gold ribbon, and lugged it to the Pinto. The cub thrashed around inside the box on his front seat while he drove like a maniac to Sarah's farm. Sarah's parents hadn't really worked the family farm much since her granddad died, just kept geese and a big garden, and when they moved south to escape the winters, Sarah kept the farm. Kevin used to help out before he went to jail. He lost his nerve and left the gyrating package on her paint-peeled porch. The phone was ringing when he got back.
"Kevin, what is this? It nearly took my arm off."
He breathed slowly. He'd enrolled in an anger management class while in jail, not because he had problems with anger, but because the textbook looked interesting, and he found the breathing helped calm him.
"Sarah, it's a saber-toothed tiger."
"They're extinct."
Yeah, so's the Bill of Rights. But this thing is a clone, from frozen meat."
"And this concerns me how?"
It's, look,
Kevin, I remember the Maine Coon kittens you gave me. I love those cats. But this is different, no? You must have stolen this thing from the college, and that's not all. It's going to grow up and be really aggressive and, well, also...
"Sorry. I'll come and get her back. Don't let her out, though. I'm not sure she knows how to defend herself."
When he got to the farm, Sarah acted nervous, but she kissed him, and they sat on the couch and talked about Ed, about jail. They didn't have sex, but he got his hopes up they could reconnect. Jonesy, meantime, tried to shred everything in her living room. She had put out a bowl of hamburger, otherwise the cub might have started shredding their clothes.
"It's not exactly cute," she said.
Jonesy's whiskers were almost as amazing as her teeth, long and delicate. She stalked everything in the room, even shadows. Kevin watched. The cub would hunker down and wriggle her backside, then dart forward and roll upside down. The hunker-wriggle part looked like any cat, but he'd never seen an animal do a half-roll while attacking. Did that have anything to do with the sword-like canines?
"Kevin, you know I love animals."
Kevin said nothing. Their shoulders touched, and he put his hand on hers. She left it there.
"Okay, until you get a place of your own. Don't come visiting without calling, though."
She withdrew her hand. Somebody was living with her, of course. The arrangement lasted 3 weeks. When he drove over in answer to her phone call, Sarah was crying. Jonesy had killed one of her geese, a real achievement, since even Rosebud was loath to fool with the geese. But when Kevin opened the door, he boggled at how much the saber-tooth had grown. Jonesy had to weigh as much as Rosebud now. Oops. What if Jonesy had attacked Sarah?
"I let her run," she said. You can't keep an animal like this cooped up, and it killed Emily Dickinson.
Emily Dickinson was one of her geese. She named her geese after women poets. What have you been feeding her? He felt shame that he hadn't offered to pay for Jonesy's food, as if he could. He had a sudden panic over the welfare of the two Maine Coon cats, but they were dozing on the sofa. The sofa was shredded, but the cats were fine.
I feed her canned dog food, but she's always hungry. I haven't seen a raccoon in the neighborhood for 2 weeks. Kevin, I don't know where you can take her, but she can't stay here.
Was Jonesy grown enough to survive on her own, on garbage, raccoons, and people's geese? How did she learn to eat the raccoons?
When I separated them, Emily kind of split open, you know? And Jonesy stood over Emily, and then, as if she was sorry for the poor goose, she bent over and started licking her feathers, and she tasted the blood. And all of a sudden,
Kevin had seen barn cats experience this epiphany. They discover their toy tastes good. Most learn from the mother cat, but get them hungry enough.
She doesn't bother the geese anymore. They run away. But then there's the deer.
Kevin looked at his baby monster. Jonesy couldn't take down a deer.
Maybe not, but she sure knows how to chase them. And I worry about Mr. Trumbull's cows.
Kevin stood. Thanks for taking care of her. She took his hand, then moved closer. They gazed at each other. Could he kiss her? She stepped back.
Take her somewhere. Hey, what about your dad's old trailer?
The trailer featured scarcely more than a bed and a mini dinette abandoned on the lot near his mother's apartment. Roof leaked, plumbing wasn't connected. No trailer park would let him in with that wreck. Nor with an exotic animal. Even if he could pass Jonesy off as a rescued bobcat or lion cub. I'll call around. He had bought a collar and leash, and he snapped these on Jonesy. Jonesy had been on leash before and didn't like it, but she trusted Kevin enough not to fight. Kevin was becoming an expert on Smilodons. They weren't even from the same branch of the Felidae family as lions and tigers, but still might live in families. He must seem to Jonesy like her mother, or the leader of her, what did they call lion families? Pride. He smiled at Sarah, eyes full of hope.
Go,
she said, shoving him playfully. The saber-tooth bared huge teeth at Sarah until she smoothed its back fur.
You can come back. Bring Jonesy if you can control her. Just call first.
He led the saber-tooth to his car. His mind roiled with possibility. Ask her, he thought. She's got a new guy, or she doesn't. Ask. Too many secrets in Kevin's life. An animal he couldn't give up and couldn't keep, and a girl he wanted and whose life had become a mystery. Cat, he said. We ain't neither of us got no pride. Kevin's uncle owned some unworked farmland 20 miles out of town center. He got permission to park the trailer there, planning to haul water and use cartridges for gas heat. He bought a generator and parked the trailer well back from the road. Odd jobs weren't enough. His mom's restaurant needed a dishwasher. Since the owner knew him and about the jail time, there was no background check problem. Kevin bought a cell phone that didn't require a credit card, and the modern man out of his time and Ice Age cat went there to live their hard life. College plans receded into mist. Maybe someday Kevin could write a book about this. He bought a cheap digital camera and started a journal of the Jonesy's growth and behavior. The saber-tooth soon learned to paw open the refrigerator,
Kevin was forced to keep only vegetables in it. To supplement the dog food, he brought home a cut-up chicken or a chuck steak every night. Jonesy tore into these, sometimes before Kevin could get the wrapper off. Sometimes the wrapper would get impaled on the 4-inch-long canines, and she would run around the room trying to scrape them off. Kevin fell down laughing the first time that happened. Kevin's own meals were either vegetarian or eaten at the restaurant. He bought a used copy of Born Free at a yard sale. Jonesy wasn't any kind of modern cat, but it was a start. The librarian found him treatises on the Smilodons of North America, though he wasn't even sure that's what Jonesy was. He had to play it cool when the librarian got nosy about his interest in cloning. Jonesy shredded any book he brought home. To her, books, like everything else, were toys. So his reading was restricted to the library and their internet computers. And since he didn't like leaving the cat alone when she was awake, he kept all his research in his head. He couldn't keep the saber tooth pinned up any more than Sarah could, so after a few weeks, he let her off the long line he'd tied to the trailer and watched her lope the perimeter of the mowed area, where the demolished farmhouse had set. The line wouldn't hold her anyway, if she wanted to get away. She would chew through chain, though it might damage her beautiful teeth. She stopped periodically to smell things, and her ears perked at the passage of a bird. Then she saw the fox, and he thought he'd have to change her name to Turbo. Did she eat the fox? No doubt she'd caught it. No bloody carcass in the trampled-down area where the chase had ended. But for 2 days later, Jonesy looked quite pleased with herself. The rest of that summer, the winter, and spring, the saber tooth grew sleek and menacing, muscles moving smoothly under short, tawny fur. One of her magnificent eye teeth loosened. When it fell out, she let Kevin feel inside her mouth and underneath where it had been. He felt a new, sharp point under the gum, which grew and grew and grew. The other side did the same, and one morning he woke up to her heavy paws on his chest and opened his eyes to see her monstrous white, glistening sabers, new and sharp and creamy white, each as long as the knife they used in the restaurant kitchen to hack apart beef joints. Her inscrutable face and hot, moist breath made his heart jump with terror. But she was his companion. He had held her under his shirt. He had fed her milk. He reached up and stroked her ears, which alone of her fur retained kittenish silkiness. Then, with the greatest caution, he touched her saber fangs, smooth like ivory knives. This meant she was Smilodon fatalis, Smilodon neogaeus, or the other genus, Meganterion? He couldn't tell. He was no paleontologist. He called Sarah to share this experience. She picked up after 2 rings and hung up. But not even Sarah's rejection could spoil that moment. He was the first man ever to touch a living Smilodon's teeth and survive. Sarah would call now and then to ask about Jonesy or to tell him about a job opening. He could leave the saber tooth with her during the day, she said. But when he called, employers always knew he was the kid who went to jail for drugs. Such is rural town gossip. Jonesy and he walked the perimeter of the farm every night, out of sight of the road. He'd been 4 years out of high school. College seemed much further away now. He thought,
Some would say I have no life. A dumbass job. Had good grades, could gone to school. Married a beautiful woman who owned land. Lost all that because I trusted the wrong person. Didn't fight the system hard enough. Could have done better. But I've touched the saber teeth of a Smilodon. And if no other gift is given me in this life, that might be enough. If Jonesy missed anything, she never said so. Then Jonesy came into heat. As she came insinuating up to him, dragging her butt against the floor, trying to hump the ragged sofa arm, beseeching him to do something, anything, he just said, "Kitten, I'd write you a personal ad, but your kind don't subscribe to the Country Crier." Neutering, but how the hell would he pass her off as anything but what she was? The vet would remember the incident in Frankenlab, and all would be up. Another jail sentence for Kevin, worse for Jonesy. Sacrifice at the hands of the scientists. He tried pinning her in the trailer while he slept in the Pinto, but she started chewing through the metal window frame. He let her out, and she howled to get inside with him. Next night, his cell phone rang.
"Kevin, Keith, whatever your name is, people hear that howling. Don't know what it is, but I do."
Kevin's heart lurched. Caller ID said B. Hartley. The scientist, Dr. Hartley. "You plan to sacrifice her now?"
"No, you dolt. Do I have to spell it out for you? I incited your stupid animals are brethren people to start that fire so she'd get away."
He took it in.
"She's in heat. What should..."
"She'll either go out of heat or she'll attack somebody. She may even decide you're the lucky Tom. Give her back to me."
"Was there another saber-tooth, a male?"
"Of course not, you idiot." He snapped the cell phone shut and threw it against a wall. Jonesy disappeared into the woods behind French Lick Creek. A week later, she slunk back. Kevin waited, but she was not knocked up. How could she be? He was pretty sure Jonesy was keeping down the deer and raccoon population, but nobody mentioned missing any dogs. Cats, maybe. When he needed to go to work, he had to lock her in the trailer, and she gnawed at the door and chewed the knob. Thank God she didn't have opposable thumbs. She was smarter than most dogs and cats, and some people. But heaven, even Kevin and Jonesy's twisted heaven, can never last. He had to run an errand. The feed store, which closed in the evening, was the cheapest place to get her dog food. How she got out and trailed him wasn't that hard to reconstruct. He'd been careless. As he walked out of the store, he nearly tripped over her sunning herself on the front steps. And across the square was Rosebud. Rosebud wasn't supposed to be out either, but Mr. Trumbull was pretty lax, too. Rosebud hated cats. And Jonesy smelled like a big, unneutered cat. Rosebud killed cats. Smart cat owners in French Creek Township kept their pets indoors. As to farm cats, thank God Rosebud couldn't climb trees. Rosebud was across the square, urinating on a post. He stopped abruptly and put his leg down. Tiny ears perked, nose twitching. Then he charged. Halfway across the square, he suddenly changed his mind. Uncertain, he froze, then turned tail. Jonesy wasn't a long-distance runner, but she was fast on a sprint. What Kevin saw next was that weird Smilodon leap. Jonesy charged and, without stopping, rolled to her back, hugged Rosebud's neck, then sank her saber teeth into the dog's throat.
The dog heaved into the air. Jonesy rolled over on top of him, and the two struggled. Rosebud had no offensive weapons but his jaws, and he'd never had to defend himself before. So his struggles turned to spasms, and in seconds, he lay still. Jonesy straddled the dog and raised her bloodied jaws in a terrifying roar. Everybody ran out of the feed store, the diner, and the gift shop. Jonesy lowered her jaws and began to tear pieces out of the dog's belly. Kevin fought vertigo and nausea. Somebody yelled, "Anybody catch that on video?" He charged across the square, screaming at Jonesy. Three guys tried to stop him, yelling, "It'll kill you!" But he slid to a stop by the scene of carnage and yanked on Jonesy's collar. "He's crazy!" somebody yelled. Kevin realized he was crazy. Jonesy weighed maybe 500 pounds by now. He'd read plenty of accounts of people mauled by previously docile big cats. Why did he assume Jonesy was different? But he had to get the cat away before somebody with a gun thought to use it. A small, strong hand gripped his wrist. Sarah. Sarah had the rifle her grandfather always carried in her truck. It had been a fixture in the truck for so long he'd forgotten about it, nor did he wonder why she happened to be in town that day. She gave him a serious look, then handed him the rifle. "It's under control," she yelled at the gathering crowd. "Back off before somebody gets hurt." The dog was mangled meat. Jonesy had ripped open its throat and its belly and was standing over it, sides heaving with desire, jaws quivering with hunger and triumph. The crowd all took a step back. "Get her in the truck," Sarah said. "You can still control her, can't you?" Jonesy roared again, a softer roar. Very deliberately. He believed that crap about animals being able to sense fear, but also knew he could fake courage pretty well. He took a handful of the loose flesh at the back of Jonesy's neck and said in a low growl, "Into the truck, bad girl." And it was over. Jonesy lowered her head and her stump of a tail and climbed into Sarah's truck. Kevin slammed the door, which left Sarah and Kevin standing outside. Sarah was shaking. She reached up and grabbed Kevin's ears and kissed him hard, tongue and all. Breaking loose, she said, "You're an idiot. But God Almighty, you've got guts." What now? Kevin couldn't leave Jonesy inside the truck. First, the saber tooth would demolish the inside. Second, it was a nice spring day. Sunny and heat would eventually build up and kill her. But he could no longer predict the cat's behavior. Jonesy's blood was up. She might boil over. "We have to get her out of here before the cops come," said Kevin. He shrugged, grabbed Sarah's keys, and sprang into the truck. Jonesy didn't kill him. The rest of his life, he would wonder why. Because he was dominant? Because she loved him? Do top predators know love? He let Jonesy out of the truck outside his trailer. She lingered, licking his hand and making begging grunts, so he opened one of the dog food cans. She took it away from him and rasped the horse meat out, then lay down in the grass. He went inside and wept. Yes, somebody had videotaped it. Not the two animals running toward each other. Not Jonesy's karate-like attack, but the dog underneath Jonesy, thrashing, then still, and Jonesy pulling out intestines. The video played several times, always zooming on the dead pit bull, then panning to Kevin pulling the cat away. He lay on the bed staring at the ceiling. Thank God the cat looked like a female lion in the video. Some bystanders remarked on its teeth, but nobody connected it with the break-in and fire at the lab a couple of years previous. In the evening, Sarah brought his car back. He didn't know how she started it. But she came in, uninvited, and lay beside him on the bed. They kissed. She said, "Lock the door." He did, obediently.
"It won't stop Jonesy, if that's what you're thinking."
Hours later, they dressed and talked about hunting for Jonesy. Did anybody recognize them from the video? It was really jerky. Nobody was knocking on the door, but Kevin's mind roiled with possibilities. If somebody recognized Sarah's truck, they'd go to her house, then figure she was here. They'd come with guns for Jonesy. Jonesy was tame. She wouldn't know to run. Hellfire. Maybe Jonesy should be put down. He said,
"I always thought you still loved me a little. Unless this is just a stress reaction."
She leaned into him, then grabbed and shook him hard enough that he thought, "She's going to slug me next." She said, "I love you, you jerk. But I couldn't keep on loving somebody who was stupid enough to go to jail for what he didn't do."
"Ed is your cousin. I wouldn't rat out your cousin. And I never was sure the pot was his anyway."
"Idiot!" And she did slap him. Not enough to hurt. Then turned away, hiding tears. "Ed is a goddamn jerk. He got you in trouble. You shielded him. He's my blood, but nobody I'd ever choose for family. Kevin! Kevin! I can't be with a man who spent time in jail and who lives with this monster."
"Do you like animals?"
She sobered. "I do. I'm not sure what you should do with Jonesy. Maybe we could get rid of her somehow, not kill her. Find somebody who would take her and keep her safe. Would you do that if I asked?"
"And we'd be like before?"
He didn't say, "And you'll marry me," but he hoped she'd know that's what he meant. "We'd at least solve a problem. I have a friend who knows how to sell things on the internet. Remember those people who tried to sell their kid on eBay?"
"They got caught."
"They were stupid. eBay's not the option I had in mind. Listen, Ed isn't the only shady character we know. Maybe we can find a place for her." He was reluctant.
"Sarah, don't get her killed."
He stayed up drinking cola after she left, but fell asleep in his lounge chair and awoke to early light and his cell phone ringtone.
"It's happened," said Hartley. "What?"
He thought she was talking about the attack on Rosebud. "Sarah Jones, that's your girl, right? The cat's over at her farm."
"Yeah, but Sarah will be okay. Jonesy loves Sarah."
"Judas Priest, boy, that cat is a top predator. Her definition of love is different from yours and mine. Big cats seem okay for years, then go off like a bomb and eviscerate somebody for no reason. For hunger, for a mate, because a fly bit them on the nose."
"She loves Sarah."
"Yeah, she loves you too. And maybe she thinks Sarah is a rival in love." That sounded crazy, but Kevin pulled his clothes back on and ran to his car. He beat the police cruisers to the farm. Josie was bashing the front door, roaring her ear-splitting roar. Not the roar of triumph she'd roared over Rosebud. Not the roar of desire she'd yowled in heat. This was rage, and she was destroying the door. as the first cruiser threw open its door and a cop sprang out with weapon drawn, the door imploded and Jonesy bounded inside. Why had he thought Sarah was safe? For some reason, oh God, maybe it was sexual rivalry. Jonesy was after her. Kevin bolted out of his car and up the porch stairs. Inside, he smelled the fury of big, enraged Cat. "I'm up here!" Sarah screamed. He pounded up the stairs three at a time. Sarah's voice came from the upstairs bedroom. Outside that closed door, Jonesy reared on her back feet, head scraping the ceiling. She clawed at the doorknob, chewed on the door panels. One door panel split and fell inward. Jonesy threw herself with renewed rage, and the door splintered. "Here, girl. Bad girl." Why hadn't he thought of bringing meat? No, meat wouldn't work. Sarah was screaming, punching at the jammed window. He raced up and grabbed the cat's collar, but she turned and knocked him flat. As he lay gasping from the blow, Jonesy lunged for Sarah. He crawled, dizzy, trying to rise despite the agony in his chest. He just reached the door when Jonesy rolled across the floor, sprang up, and sank her teeth into Sarah's throat. Sarah's eyes went wide, green as Jonesy's eyes. Her head snapped back. The cat ripped out her flesh, together with a piece of her t-shirt, then howled. Head thrown back, whiskered black nose grazing the ceiling light fixture. Then the cat leapt through the window, splintering the frame. Kevin crawled over to Sarah. Her head was nearly separated from her body, blood gushing everywhere in her beautiful golden hair, on her torn shirt, the cracked linoleum floor. More blood than he had ever seen. He buried his face in the hollow between her breasts and sobbed. Then he rose and looked out the window. Jonesy was loping into the barn. He felt his way down the stairs, shattered. Sarah was so beautiful. And Jonesy, his charge, his responsibility, his pet, had killed her. Pet? Oh, no, not a pet. No more than an astronaut would call the moon a pet. No more than a composer would call his greatest symphony a pet. No more than a mountain climber would call Everest a pet. He stumbled out into the light. Five police cruisers ringed the house now, and a paramedic van. One of the paramedics had the rifle from Sarah's truck.
"Cat still in there?" one cop yelled.
"Sarah's upstairs. She's dead," Kevin said. He sank to his knees and sobbed. Hartley appeared. The cat ran into the barn. I saw it. The paramedic raised the rifle, and another cop hauled open the barn door. He had a German shepherd with him on a short leash. Kevin pulled himself erect. The dog strained forward, then turned to cower behind the cop. The cop broke into a run, at the same time trying to unholster his service revolver. Jonesy exploded out of the barn. The cop and the dog fell down and Jonesy vaulted over them. Kevin heard the sound of the rifle being cocked. Kevin screamed, "No!" He launched himself at the rifleman. The rifleman stumbled and the shot went wild. A tawny streak, Jonesy, broke into the woods behind the barn and coursed out of sight. Hartley screamed, "Why did you do that?"
"Killing the cat won't make Sarah be alive again."
"You're in denial. The Smilodon will kill again." Kevin was silent. Hartley was right. He had no idea why he had pushed the rifleman. He felt his arms being jerked back, cuffs cut his wrists. But the saber tooth, the miracle from another world, was free. You were involved with Sarah Jones, Hartley said. I thought you loved her.
I did. Not what matters.
This monster kills the woman you love and you protect it. How could he explain? Jonesy was never found, though attacks on domestic animals and deer increased in the county for a few weeks. Maybe the saber-tooth died. Maybe she went north, where the woods were thicker and the game larger. Kevin went to jail. He got most of a college degree in there, gratis, the state. He wasn't street smart, that was obvious, but he had a talent for book learning. His life had changed forever. He got out of jail, went to university, studied paleontology, but studiously avoided Franklin Yu and Hartley, though she begged him for his photos of the Smilodon. He never married. But he had companioned a Smilodon, brought back from the depths of time. It had been like stepping on the moon. He had touched its white, saber-like teeth, and it made him immortal. It was enough.
The Burglar Takes a Cat, Lawrence Block.
Lawrence Block is a multiple winner of the Edgar Allan Poe, Shamus, and Maltese Falcon Awards, is a Mystery Writers of America Grandmaster, and has received Life Achievement Awards from France and the UK. He's a devoted New Yorker and an ardent world traveler. In The Burglar Takes a Cat, an excerpt from Block's novel The Burglar Who Traded Ted Williams, the protagonist, Bernie Rodenbar, is a bookstore owner burglar who features in a series of 10, so far, comic novels by Block. The author does not have a cat.
Look, it wasn't my idea, and it happened very quickly. One day back in early June, Carolyn brought pastrami sandwiches and celery tonic to the bookstore, and I showed her a couple of books, an Ellen Glasgow novel, and the collected letters of Evelyn Waugh. She took a look at the spines and made a sound somewhere between a tst and a cluck.
You know what did that, she said.
I have a haunting suspicion.
My spurn.
That's what I was afraid you were going to say.
Rodents, she said. Vermin. You can throw those books right in the garbage.
Maybe I should keep them. Maybe they'll eat these and leave the others alone.
Maybe you should leave a quarter under your pillow, she said. And the tooth fairy will come in the middle of the night and chew their heads off.
That doesn't seem very realistic, Carolyn.
No, she said. It doesn't. Bern, you wait right here.
Where are you going?
I won't be long, she said. Don't eat my sandwich.
I won't, but...
And don't leave it where the mice can get it either.
Mouse, I said. There's no reason to assume there's more than one.
Bern, she said. Take my word for it. There's no such thing as one mouse.
I might have figured out what she was up to, but I opened the Waugh volume while I knocked off the rest of my own sandwich, and one letter led to another. I was still at it when the door opened, and there she was back again. She was holding one of those little cardboard satchels with air holes, the kind shaped like a New England salt box house, the sort of things you carry cats in. Oh, no, I said.
Bern, give me a minute, huh?
No.
Bern, you've got mice. Your shop is infested with rodents. Do you know what that means?
It doesn't mean I'm going to be infested with cats.
Not cats, she said. There's no such thing as one mouse. There is such a thing as one cat. That's all I've got in here, Bern. One cat.
That's good, I said. You came in here with one cat, and you can leave with one cat. It makes it easy to keep track that way.
You can't just live with the mice. They'll do thousands of dollars worth of damage. They won't sit back and settle down with one volume and read it from cover to cover, you know. No, it's a bite here and a bite there, and before you know it, you're out of business.
Don't you think you're overdoing it?
No way. Bern, Remember the great library at Alexandria? One of the seven wonders of the ancient world? And then a single mouse got in there.
I thought you said there was no such thing as a single mouse.
Well, now there's no such thing as the great library at Alexandria, and all because the pharaoh's head librarian didn't have the good sense to keep a cat.
There are other ways to get rid of mice, I said.
Name one.
Poison.
Bad idea, Bern.
What's so bad about it?
Forget the cruelty aspect of it.
Okay, I said. It's forgotten.
Forget the horror of gobbling down something with warfarin in it and having all your little blood vessels burst. Forget the hideous specter of one of God's own little warm-blooded creatures dying a slow, agonizing death from internal bleeding. Forget all that, Bern, if you possibly can.
All forgotten. The memory tape's a blank.
Instead, focus on the idea of dozens of mice dying in the walls around you, where you can't see them or get at them.
Oh, well, out of sight, out of mind. Isn't that what they say?
Nobody ever said it was about dead mice. You'll have a store with hundreds of them decomposing in the walls.
Hundreds? God knows the actual number.
The poison bait's designed to draw them from all over the area. You could have mice scurrying here from miles around. Mice from Soho to Kipps Bay. All of them coming here to die.
I rolled my eyes.
Maybe I'm exaggerating a tiny bit, she allowed. But all you need is one dead mouse in the wall, and you're gonna smell a rat, Bern.
A mouse, you mean?
You know what I mean. And maybe your customers won't exactly cross the street to avoid walking past the store.
Some of them do that already.
But they won't be too happy spending time in a shop with a bad odor to it. They might drop in for a minute, but they won't browse. No book lover wants to stand around smelling rotting mice.
Traps, I suggested.
Traps? You want to set mouse traps?
The world will beat a path to my door.
What kind will you get, Bern? The kind with a powerful spring? That sooner or later you screw up while you're setting it and it takes off the tip of your finger? The kind that breaks the mouse's neck and you open up the store and there's this dead mouse with its neck broken and you've got to deal with that first thing in the morning?
Maybe one of those new glue traps, like a roach motel, but for mice.
Mice check in, but they can't check out.
That's the idea.
Great idea. There's the poor little mousie with its feet caught, whining piteously for hours, maybe trying to gnaw off its own feet in a pathetic attempt to escape, like a fox in a leg-hold trap in one of those animal rights commercials.
Carolyn.
It could happen. Who are you to say it couldn't happen? Anyway, you come in and open the store, and there's the mouse, still alive. And then what do? Stomp on it? Get a gun and shoot it? Fill the sink and drown it?
Suppose I just drop it in the garbage, trap and all.
Now that's humane, she said. Poor thing's half suffocated in the dark for days, and then the garbage men toss the bag in the hopper and it gets ground up into mouse burger. That's terrific, Bern. While you're at it, why not drop the trap into the incinerator? Why not burn the poor creature alive?
I remembered something. You can release the mice from glue traps, I said. You pour a little baby oil on their feet and it acts as a solvent for the glue. The mouse just runs off, none the worse for wear.
None the worse for wear?
Well,
Bern, she said, don't you realize what you'd be doing? You'd be releasing a psychotic mouse. Either it would find its way back into the store, or it would get into one of those neighboring buildings, and who's to say what it would do? Even if you let it go miles from here, even if you took it clear out to Flushing, you'd be unleashing a deranged rodent upon the unsuspecting public. Bern, forget traps, forget poison. You don't need any of that.
She tapped the side of the cat carrier.
You've got a friend, she said.
You're not talking friends. You're talking cats.
What have you got against cats?
I haven't got anything against cats. I haven't got anything against elk either. But that doesn't mean I'm going to keep one in the store so I'll have a place to hang my hat.
I thought you liked cats.
They're okay.
You're always sweet to Archie and Ubi. I figured you were fond of them.
I am fond of them, I said. I think they're fine in their place, and their place happens to be your apartment. Carolyn, believe me, I don't want a pet. I'm not the type. If I can't even keep a steady girlfriend, how can I keep a pet?
Pets are easier, she said with feeling. Believe me. Anyway, this cat's not a pet.
Then what is it?
An employee, she said. A working cat. A companion animal by day, a solitary night watchman when you're gone, a loyal, faithful, hard-working servant.
Meow,
the cat said. We both glanced at the cat carrier, and Carolyn bent down to unfasten its clasps.
"He's cooped up in there," she said.
"Don't let him out."
"Oh, come on," she said,
doing just that.
"We're not talking Pandora's box here, Bern. I'm just letting him get some air."
"That's what the air holes are for."
"He needs to stretch his legs," she said.
And the cat emerged and did just that, extending his front legs and stretching, then doing the same for his rear legs. You know how cats do, like they're warming up for a dance class. "He," I said.
"It's a male?"
"Well, at least it won't be having kittens all the time."
"Absolutely not," she said. "He's guaranteed not to have kittens."
"But won't he run around peeing on things? Like books, for instance.
Don't male cats make a habit of that sort of thing?" "He's post-op, Bern."
"Poor guy."
"He doesn't know what he's missing. But he won't have kittens, and he won't father them either. Or go nuts yowling whenever there's a female cat in heat somewhere between 34th Street and the Battery. Nope, he'll just do his job, guarding the store and keeping the mice down."
"And using the books for a scratching post. What's the point of getting rid of mice if the books all wind up with claw marks?"
"No claws, Bern."
"Oh."
"He doesn't really need them, since there aren't a lot of enemies to fend off in here. Or a whole lot of trees to climb."
"I guess." I looked at him. There was something strange about him. But it took me a second or two to figure it out. "Carolyn," I said, "what happened to his tail?"
"He's a Manx."
"So he was born tailless. But don't Manx cats have a sort of hopping gait? Almost like a rabbit? This guy just walks around like your ordinary garden variety cat. He doesn't look much like any Manx I ever saw."
"Well, maybe he's only part Manx."
"Which part? The tail?"
"Well."
"What do you figure happened? Did he get it caught in the door? Or did the vet get carried away?" "I'll tell you, Carolyn, he's been neutered and declawed, and his tail's no more than a memory. When you come right down to it, there's not a whole lot of the original cat left, is there? What we've got here is the stripped-down economy model. Is there anything else missing that I don't know about?"
"No."
"Did they leave the part that knows how to use a litter box? That's going to be tons of fun, changing the litter every day. Does he at least know how to use a box?"
"Even better, Bern. He uses the toilet."
"Like Archie and Ubi?" Carolyn had trained her own cats, first by keeping their litter pan on top of the toilet seat, then by cutting a hole in it, gradually enlarging the hole, and finally getting rid of the pan altogether. "Well, that's something," I said. "I don't suppose he's figured out how to flush it."
"No. And don't leave the seat up."
I sighed heavily. The animal was stalking around my store, poking his head into corners. Surgery or no surgery, I kept waiting for him to cock a leg at a shelf full of first editions. I admit it, I didn't trust the little bastard. "I don't know about this," I said. "There must be a way to mouse-proof a store like this. Maybe I should talk it over with an exterminator."
"Are you kidding? You want some weirdo skulking around the aisles, spraying toxic chemicals all over the place? Bern, you don't have to call an exterminator. You've got a live-in exterminator. Your own personal organic rodent control division. He's had all his shots, he's free of fleas and ticks, and if he ever needs grooming, you've got a friend in the business. What more could you ask for?"
I felt myself weakening, and I hated that. "He seems to like it here," I admitted. "He acts as though he's right at home."
"And why not? What could be more natural than a cat in a bookstore?"
"He's not bad-looking," I said. "Once you get used to the absence of a tail. And that shouldn't be too hard, given that I was already perfectly accustomed to the absence of an entire cat. What color would you say he was?"
"Gray tabby."
"It's a nice functional look," I decided. "Nothing flashy about it. But it goes with everything, doesn't it? Has he got a name?"
"Bern, you can always change it."
"No, I bet it's a Pip."
"Well, it's not horrendous. At least I don't think it is. But he's like most cats I've known. He doesn't respond to his name. You know how Archie and Ubi are? Calling them by name is a waste of time. If I want them to come, I just run the electric can opener."
"What's his name, Carolyn?"
"Raffles," she said. "But you can change it to anything you want. Feel free."
"Raffles," I said.
"If you hate it."
"Hate it?" I stared at her. "Are you kidding? It's got to be the perfect name for him."
"How do you figure that, Bern?"
"Don't you know who Raffles was? In the books by E.W. Hornung back around the turn of the century. And in the stories Barry Perrone's been doing recently. Raffles, the amateur cracksman? World-class cricket player and gentleman burglar? I can't believe you never heard of the celebrated A.J. Raffles. Her mouth fell open.
I never made the connection, she said. All I could think of was like raffling off a car to raise funds for a church. But now that you mention it.
Raffles, I said. The quintessential burglar of fiction. And here he is, a cat in a bookstore. And the bookstore is owned by a former burglar. I'll tell you, if I were looking for a name for the cat, I couldn't possibly do better than the one he came with. Her eyes met mine.
Bernie,
she said solemnly,
it was meant to be.
Meow,
said Raffles. At noon the following day, it was my turn to pick up lunch. I stopped at the falafel stand on the way to the poodle factory. Carolyn asked how Raffles was doing.
He's doing fine, I said. He drinks from his water bowl and eats out of his new blue cat dish. And I'll be damned if he doesn't use the toilet just the way you said he did.
Of course, I have to remember to leave the door ajar, but when I forget, he reminds me by standing in front of it and yowling.
It sounds as though it's working out.
Oh, it's working out marvelously, I said. Tell me something. What was his name before it was Raffles?
I don't follow you, Byrne. I don't follow you, Byrne.
That was the crowning touch, wasn't it? You waited until you had me pretty well softened up, and then you tossed in the name as a sort of coup de foie gras. His name's Raffles, but you can always change it. Where did the cat come from?
Didn't I tell you? A customer of mine, he's a fashion photographer. He has a really gorgeous Irish water spaniel, and he told me about a friend of his who developed asthma and was heartbroken because his allergist insisted he had to get rid of his cat.
And then what happened?
Then you developed a mouse problem. So I went and picked up the cat and...
No.
No?
I shook my head. You're leaving something out. All I had to do was mention the word mouse, and you were out of here like a cat out of hell. You didn't even have to think about it. And it couldn't have taken you more than 20 minutes to go and get the cat and stick it in a carrying case and come back with it. How did you spend those 20 minutes? Let's see. First you went back to the poodle factory to look up the number of your customer, the fashion photographer, and then you called him and asked for the name and number of his friend with the allergies. Then, I guess, you called the friend and introduced yourself and arranged to meet him at his apartment and take a look at the animal and then...
Stop it!
Well?
The cat was at my apartment.
What was he doing there?
He was living there, Byrne.
I frowned. I've met your cats, I said. I've known them for years. I'd recognize them with or without tails. Archie's a sable Burmese and Ubi's a Russian blue. Neither one of them could pass for a gray tabby, except maybe in a dark alley.
He was living with Archie and Ubi, she said.
Since when?
Oh, just for a little while.
I thought for a moment. Not for just a little while, I said, because he was there long enough to learn the toilet trick. You don't learn something like that overnight. Look how long it takes with human beings. That's how he learned, right? He picked it up from your cats, didn't he?
I suppose so.
And he didn't pick it up overnight either, did he?
I feel like a suspect, she said. I feel as though I'm being grilled.
Grilled? You ought to be charbroiled. You set me up and euchred me, for heaven's sake. How long has Raffles been living with you?
2.5 months.
2.5 months?
Oh, maybe it's more like 3.
3 months? That's unbelievable. How many times have I been over to your place in the past 3 months? It's got to be 8 or 10 at the very least. Are you telling me I looked at the cat and didn't even notice him?
When you came over, she said, I used to put him in the other room.
What other room? You live in one room.
I put him in the closet.
In the closet?
Uh-huh. So you wouldn't see him.
But why?
The same reason I never mentioned him.
Why's that? I don't get it. Were you ashamed of him? What's wrong with him anyway?
There's nothing wrong with him.
Because if there's something shameful about the animal, I don't know that I want him hanging around my store.
There's nothing shameful about him, she said. He's a perfectly fine cat. He's trustworthy, he's loyal, he's helpful and friendly.
Courteous, kind, I said. Obedient, cheerful, thrifty. He's a regular Boy Scout, isn't he? So why the hell were you keeping him a secret from me?
It wasn't just you, Byrne, honest. I was keeping him a secret from everybody.
But why, Carolyn?
I don't even want to say it.
Come on, for God's sake. She took a breath.
Because,
she said darkly,
he was the third cat.
You lost me.
Oh, God. This is impossible to explain. Bernie, there's something you have to understand. Cats can be very dangerous for a woman. What are you talking about? You start with one, she said. And that's fine, no problem, nothing wrong with that. And then you get a second one, and that's even better, as a matter of fact, because they keep each other company. It's a curious thing, but it's actually easier to have two cats than one.
I'll take your word for it.
Then you get a third. And that's all right. It's still manageable. But before you know it, you take in a fourth, and then you've gone and done it.
Done what?
You've crossed a line.
What line? And how have you crossed it?
You've become a woman with cats.
I nodded. Light was beginning to dawn.
You know the kind of woman I mean, she went on. They're all over the place. They don't have any friends, and they hardly ever set foot outdoors. And when they die, people discover 30 or 40 cats in their house. Or they're cooped up in an apartment with 30 or 40 cats, and the neighbors take them to court to evict them because of the filth and the smell. Or they seem perfectly normal. And then there's a fire, or a break-in or something, and the world finds them out for what they are. They're women with cats, Bernie. And that's not what I want to be.
No, I said. And I can see why, but...
It doesn't seem to be a problem for men, she said. There are lots of men with two cats, and probably plenty with three or four. When did you ever hear anything about a man with cats? When it comes to cats, men don't seem to have trouble knowing when to stop.
She frowned.
Funny, isn't it? In every other area of their lives.
Let's stick to cats, I suggested.
How did you happen to wind up with Raffles hanging out in your closet?
And what was his name before it was Raffles? She shook her head.
Forget it, Byrne. It was a real pussy name, if you ask me. Not right for the cat at all. As far as how I got him, well, it happened pretty much the way I said. Except there were a few things I left out. George Brill is a customer of mine. I groom his Irish water spaniel.
And his friend is allergic to cats.
No, George is the one who's allergic. And when Felipe moved in with George, the cat had to go. The dog and cat got along fine, but George was wheezing and red-eyed all the time, so Felipe had to give up either George or the cat.
And that was it for Raffles.
Well, Felipe wasn't all that attached to the cat. It wasn't his cat in the first place, it was Patrick's.
Where did Patrick come from?
Ireland. And he wouldn't get a green card, and he didn't like it here that much anyway, so when he went back home he left the cat with Felipe, because he couldn't take him through immigration. Felipe was willing to give the cat a home, but when he and George got together, well, the cat had to go.
And how come you were elected to take him?
George tricked me into it.
What did he do? Tell you the poodle factory was infested with mice?
No. He used some pretty outrageous emotional blackmail on me. Anyway, it worked. The next thing I knew, I had a third cat.
How did Archie and Ubi feel about it?
They didn't actually say anything, but their body language translated into something along the lines of, "There goes the neighborhood." I don't think it broke their hearts yesterday when I packed him up and took him out of there.
But in the meantime, he spent 3 months in your apartment and you never said a word.
I was planning on telling you, Byrne.
When?
Sooner or later. But I was afraid.
Of what I would think?
Not only that. Afraid of what the third cat signified.
She heaved a sigh.
All those women with cats, she said. They didn't plan on it, Byrne. They got a first cat, they got a second cat, they got a third cat, and all of a sudden they were gone.
You don't think they might have been the least bit odd to begin with?
No, she said. No, I don't. Oh, once in a while, maybe. You get a slightly wacko lady, and next thing you know, she's up to her armpits in cats. But most of the cat ladies start out normal. By the time you get to the end of the story, they're nuts, all right. But having 30 or 40 cats will do that to you. It sneaks up on you. And before you know it, you're over the edge.
And the third cat's the charm, huh?
No question. Byrne, there are primitive cultures that don't really have numbers. Not in the sense that we do. They have a word that means one, and other words for two and three, and after that there's a word that just means more than three. And that's how it is in our culture with cats. You can have one cat, you can have two cats. You can even have three cats. But after that, you've got more than three.
And you're a woman with cats.
You got it.
I got it, all right. I've got your third cat. Is that the real reason you never mentioned it? Because you were planning all along to palm the little bugger off on me?
No, she said quickly. Swear to God, Byrne. A couple of times over the years the subject of a dog, a cat, has come up, and you've always said you didn't want a pet. Did I ever once press you?
No.
I took you at your word. It sometimes crossed my mind that you might have a better time in life if you had an animal to love, but I managed to keep it to myself. It never even occurred to me that you could use a working cat. And then when I found out about your rodent problem, you knew just how to solve it. Well, sure. And it's a great solution, isn't it? Admitted Byrne. Didn't it do your heart good this morning to have Raffles there to greet you?
It was all right, I admitted. At least he was still alive. I had visions of him lying there dead with his paws in the air, and the mice forming a great circle around his body.
See, you're concerned about him, Byrne. Before you know it, you're going to fall in love with the little guy.
Don't hold your breath. Carolyn? What was his name before it was Raffles?
Oh, forget it. It was a stupid name.
Tell me.
Do I have to?
She sighed.
Well, it was Andrew.
Andrew? What's so stupid about that? Andrew Jackson, Andrew Johnson, Andrew Carnegie?
Not Andrew, Byrne. Andrew.
Andrew Mellon, Andrew Gardner, not Andrew. Andrew?
Right.
What's that? Greek for Andrew? She shook her head.
It's short for androgynous.
Oh.
The idea being that his surgery had left the cat somewhat uncertain from a sexual standpoint.
Oh.
Which I gather was also the case for Patrick, although I don't believe surgery had anything to do with it.
Oh.
I never called him Andro myself, she said. Actually, I didn't call him anything. I didn't want to give him a new name because that would mean I was leaning toward keeping him and...
I understand.
And then on the way over to the bookstore, it just came to me in a flash. Raffles.
As in raffling off a car to raise money for a church, I think you said.
Don't hate me, Byrne.
I'll try not to.
It's been no picnic, living a lie for the past 3 months. Believe me.
I guess it'll be easier for everybody now that Raffles is out of the closet.
I know it will. Byrne, I didn't want to trick you into taking the cat.
Of course you did.
No, I didn't. I just wanted to make it as easy as possible for you and the cat to start off on the right foot. I knew you'd be crazy about him once you got to know him, and I thought anything I could do to get you over the first hurdle, any minor deception I might have to practice.
Like lying your head off?
It was in a good cause. I had only your best interests at heart, Byrne. Yours and the cat's.
And your own?
Well, yeah,
she said, and flashed a winning smile.
But it worked out, didn't it? Byrne, you've got to admit it worked out.
We'll see, I said.
The White Cat, Joyce Carol Oates.
Joyce Carol Oates is one of the most prolific and respected writers in the United States today. Oates has written fiction in almost every genre and medium. Her keen interest in the gothic and psychological horror has spurred her to write dark suspense novels under the name Rosamund Smith, to write enough stories in the genre to have published 5 collections of dark fiction, the most recent being The Museum of Dr. Moses, Tales of Mystery and Suspense, and Wild Nights, stories about the last days of Poe, Dickinson, Twain, James, and Hemingway, and to edit American Gothic Tales. Oates's short novel, Zombie, won the Bram Stoker Award, and she has been honored with the Stoker Award for Lifetime Achievement by the Horror Writers Association. Oates's most recent novels are Blood Mask, The Grave Digger's Daughter, and My Sister, My Love, The Intimate Story of Skylar Rampike. She teaches creative writing at Princeton, and with her late husband, Raymond J. Smith, ran the small press and literary magazine, The Ontario Review, for many years. Oates is a cat lover, and has written several dark stories about cats. This one could be seen as the inverse of Edgar Allan Poe's The Black Cat.
There was a gentleman of independent means who, at about the age of 56, conceived of a passionate hatred for his much younger wife's white Persian cat. His hatred for the cat was all the more ironic and puzzling in that he himself had given the cat to his wife as a kitten years ago when they were first married. and he himself had named her Miranda, after his favorite Shakespearean heroine. It was ironic, too, in that he was hardly a man given to irrational sweeps of emotion. Except for his wife, whom he'd married late, his first marriage, her second, he did not love anyone very much, and would have thought it beneath his dignity to hate anyone. For whom should he take that seriously? Being a gentleman of independent means allowed him that independence of spirit, unknown to the majority of men. Julius Muir was of slender build, with deep-set, somber eyes of no distinctive color, thinning, graying, baby-fine hair, and a narrow, lined face to which the adjective lapidary had once been applied, with no vulgar invention of mere flattery. Being of old American stock, he was susceptible to none of the fashionable tugs and sways of identity. He knew who he was, who his ancestors were, and thought the subject of no great interest. His studies, both in America and abroad, had been undertaken with a dilettante's rather than a scholar's pleasure. But he would not have wished to make too much of them. Life, after all, is a man's primary study. Fluent in several languages, Mr. Muir had a habit of phrasing his words with inordinate care, as if he were translating them into a common vernacular. He carried himself with an air of discreet self-consciousness that had nothing in it of vanity or pride, yet did not bespeak a pointless humility. He was a collector, primarily of rare books and coins, but he was certainly not an obsessive collector. He looked upon the fanaticism of certain of his fellows with a bemused disdain. So his quickly blossoming hatred for his wife's beautiful white cat surprised him, and for a time amused him. Or did it frighten him? Certainly he didn't know what to make of it. The animosity began as an innocent sort of domestic irritation, a half-conscious sense that being so respected in public, so recognized as the person of quality and importance he assuredly was, he should warrant that sort of treatment at home. Not that he was naively ignorant of the fact that cats have a way of making their preferences known that lacks the subtlety and tact devised by human beings. But as the cat grew older and more spoiled and ever more choosy, it became evident that she did not, for affection, choose him. Alyssa was her favorite, of course, then one or another of the help. But it was not uncommon for a stranger visiting the Muirs for the first time to win, or to appear to win, Miranda's capricious heart.
"Miranda! Come here!"
Mr. Muir might call, gently enough, yet forcibly, treating the animal, in fact, with a silly sort of deference. But at such times, Miranda was likely to regard him with indifferent, unblinking eyes and make no move in his direction. What a fool, she seemed to be saying, to court someone who cares so little for you. If he tried to lift her in his arms, if he tried, with a show of playfulness, to subdue her, in true cat fashion she struggled to get down with as much violence as if a stranger had seized her. Once, as she squirmed out of his grasp, she accidentally raked the back of his hand and drew blood that left a faint stain on the sleeve of his dinner jacket.
"Julius, dear, are you hurt?"
Alyssa asked.
"Not at all,"
Mr. Muir said, dabbing at the scratches with a handkerchief.
"I think Miranda is excited because of the company," Alyssa said. "You know how sensitive she is."
"Indeed I do," Mr. Muir said mildly, winking at their guests.
But a pulse beat hard in his head, and he was thinking he would like to strangle the cat with his bare hands, were he the kind of man who was capable of such an act. More annoying still,
was the routine nature of the cat's aversion to him. When he and Alyssa sat together in the evening, reading, each at an end of their sofa, Miranda would frequently leap unbidden into Alyssa's lap, but shrink fastidiously from Mr. Muir's very touch. He professed to be hurt. He professed to be amused.
"I'm afraid Miranda doesn't like me any longer," he said sadly, though in truth he could no longer remember if there'd been a time the creature had liked him, when she'd been a kitten, perhaps, and utterly indiscriminate in her affections.
Alyssa laughed and said apologetically, "Of course she likes you, Julius," as the cat purred loudly and sensuously in her lap. "But you know how cats are."
"Indeed, I am learning,"
Mr. Muir said with a stiff little smile, and he felt he was learning something to which he could give no name. What first gave him the idea, the fancy, really, of killing Miranda, he could not have afterward said. One day, watching her rubbing about the ankles of a director friend of his wife's, observing how wantonly she presented herself to an admiring little circle of guests, even people with a general aversion to cats could not resist exclaiming over Miranda, petting her, scratching her behind the ears, cooing over her like idiots. Mr. Muir found himself thinking that, as he had brought the cat into his household of his own volition and had paid a fair amount of money for her, she was his to dispose of as he wished.